Hello and welcome to First 7-Inch Club, episode 57. First 7-Inch Club is a podcast where we dig up a 7-inch by a forgotten or obscure band within the realms of hardcore, punk, and metal and discuss whether or not they're worth being remembered. We'll also provide factoids and trivia that we get from the internet and our own personal experiences. Although we don't consider ourselves know-it-alls or experts, many other people do. Sometimes we make mistakes. We are only modestly getting information from the internet, from the dark sources of the internet, so sometimes things are wrong. Take it lightly. We are here for jokes. I am Mike, and with me is Scott.
Mike, do you have any hobbies where you care about, like, the whole chain of production, like the provenance, the process from the beginning to end? Like, every part of it is important to you. Like, if you know your priceless Hummels or your precious moments figures, they need to have been painted by hands. If a robot is in the system somewhere, it fucks up the whole thing. Do you have any hobbies like that?
I unfortunately care way too much about the inner workings of wrestling. I don't know if that really counts, yeah. Though, but as far as collecting, like, I might probably check how a shirt is printed a little more than a normal person would, but I don't really have anything. I'm not too hardcore of anything outside of wrestling, probably. And even wrestling, I wish I didn't know half of this stuff. It just comes with the territory, though, unfortunately.
Yeah, like, could wrestling be ruined for you? Like, would one fact ruin wrestling for you?
Do you mean in, like, a problematic way, or just, like, if I found out maybe something wasn't as high quality as I expected or something?
I guess that would be it. I guess it would be, because, I mean, we all know that wrestling is, you know, it's acted.
Yeah. Like,
anything you do in that circumstance, to me, seems like you should be able to get away with it as long as you're getting the result you want. But
yeah, I don't think anything could be ruined, because wrestling is basically like porn without the porn as far as the industry goes. So it's pretty gross. Yeah. It's, you know, everybody involved is like an attention whore that just, like, seeks attention, and that's why they hurt themselves. So
yeah,
there's not much morally that can be done or quality wise that can be done to tear me away from wrestling. Unfortunately, I wish there was, but I'm stuck with it. Unfortunately,
I wish I could get free of this thing.
Yeah.
So you showed me a while ago, you showed me this guy. I think he posts as The Ingroove. Is that his name? He's like a record reviewer guy or In the Groove or whatever. He's like a record store owner from...
Oh, yeah, that fucking guy, yeah, In the Groove, yeah, or something, yeah, like that. Yeah.
So he reviews extremely valuable vinyl for the most... I mean, maybe he does other stuff too. And, like, in my opinion, from watching a few videos, he's a maniac, but he seems fair about some things. Like, he basically starts from the premise, okay, we're talking about people who are willing to spend $400 on a record. So from there, I'm just going to talk to you from that point. So that's okay. Like, that's fair. If you start there... Yeah. And you're like, now I'm going to be really nitpicky because I paid $400 for this record. It should be really good. So here's why it's not. That's okay. So our friend Carl, he posted and then deleted a post about this guy where basically the Ingroove guy wrecked a company this week. He just ruined Christmas for a whole bunch of vinyl people because he deduced from some, like, manic vinyl brain power that one of the bigger producers of overpriced vinyl is using a digital process somewhere along the way.
Oh, my God.
Somewhere along the way, a computer is in the mix. That's all. Like, that's all that happened. And, this is a hobby where men spend...
Yeah.
They've spent decades buying $150 Electric Light Orchestra records.
Yeah. For those that don't know, so this guy, he owns a record store, and he's a record collector, and his record player setup looks like 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's just like insane shit. But what Scott's talking about is these things that I honestly didn't even know existed until I started watching this guy, which is audiophile records, which is just, like, you know, it's supposed to be the most pristine sound, and it is something like an ELO record, but it's $150 brand new. Like, you're paying that upfront, like $100 to $200 to listen to, like, one Cole Porter record or something like that.
Yeah, it's all dad rock and jazz.
Yeah,
it's all.
And supposedly these people, like, you know, with their fucking sci-fi spaceship setups, they can tell the difference between this and your regular $10 to $20 record.
So, you know, these people think that all the way from Jeff Lynne to their ears is just analog.
Yeah.
And whoops, that's a lie. And I don't care about this revelation. I assume you don't really care about this revelation.
No.
But the thing to keep in mind is that this company, MoFi, Mobile Fidelity, they're supposed to be one of the good ones. Like, people like these records. Yeah. They buy the records. They've been enjoying them. And they found out that there's paprika in the recipe, and that's it. They're just out, fucking out. And, you know, the very funny revelation, I think, is if you actually watch the interview with the guys, one of the higher ups at MoFi was like, oh, you're lying. We don't do anything digital here. Come see. So he goes to interview the guys who do the work. These are three dudes who very definitely master vintage vinyl for a living. You can tell by looking that that's their job. And they're immediately like, oh yeah, we immediately digitize everything that comes in the house. It goes right into a computer. First step, like we freeze it in a computer so we have a good copy to work from. Of course. Of course you do. Like that's what you do. So, I mean,
what was I didn't watch this video. Does he explain what the alternative would be? Like how else they would do this? Because I don't know. Was he?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
they think it's supposed to be tape all the way. So they think it's supposed to be like from the like original the tape,
or not even the DAT. It would be like that's the real too. Reel.
You can't use that shit. It's got to be like 2-inch tape from some machine in the 70s or whatever, and then that's somehow been saved or salvaged or whatever or restored, and then all the way along it's all just other tapes and vinyl and other things. I don't know what the process they think happens is. I don't know how you think you restore broken degraded sound without a computer. Like that's I'd be very fascinated to like what beyond the black rainbow universe they think that they're living in, where a guy with like a big wheel is like fixing audio. But I'm all results with my hobbies. Like if you give me something and the thing is cool, like that's good enough. Like, you know, we bought that script from Alice.
Yeah.
It came from Alice. That's cool. I think that's neat that changed hands from people who, you know, were actually working on Alice. But it didn't have to. That could have been like a spare from a storeroom and I still would have thought it was cool. So I don't know. It doesn't really matter to me. But some other disappointing world building is that they didn't even wait. I don't even think they waited 2 weeks before Klondike said, oh, forget it. We're actually going to bring back the Choco Taco. That is the worst world building I've ever seen. They had it. They had the heat. They had the story. They had it was in their hands. Actually, you know, it's probably going to be back. It'll just be back. Forget it. Forget we said anything. I just would have expected. I mean, these are the guys who wrote the jingle for What Would You Do for a Klondike Bar. That captivated a generation. That caught the imagination of children young and old. And then they had this moment of heat and they're like, no, we can't handle it. It's too hot. We got to let it go.
In a way, you got to think it might be because they understand people's attention spans are pretty short these days. So if they were like a month from now, if they were like, oh, we're bringing back the Choco Taco, people might be like, what? They really took away the Choco Taco? I didn't even know. So
well, that's the move is to wait like a year. And then just all of a sudden post a picture of a Choco Taco on Twitter with no explanation.
Yeah.
And have all the dorks be like, oh my God. And then a poll or something like that, or, or vote or whatever. And they didn't do any of that. They just said, nah, forget it. Forget this whole thing we were doing.
It's okay. First, I just wanted to say that last week we did a record by a band called Automaton. Automaton, I said that right.
Yeah.
And they were kind of a grindy band and they had 9 tracks. I think that we're going to put the kibosh on that. We're talking about that off the air.
Yep.
If we end up reviewing some type of grindy band that has 5 or more tracks, we're probably going to do it by sides from now on. We haven't gotten any feedback like, oh, that was too long or anything, but 1-minute songs, I don't think they need in-depth track by track discussion. So for the sake of brevity and keeping the show a bit under an hour and a half, we're gonna probably do by sides instead, because it's just makes it easier for everybody.
You gotta force the jokes a little bit when you're like nine tracks into a grind record. Like I'll still listen to a grind record.
Outside of that, I was gonna do a bit today, because last week we talked about how every day is basically some made-up holiday just to keep us living and breathing, and I was gonna start a bit where I was gonna just read the made-up holidays of the day, even though we record on Monday and release on Wednesdays, so they'd be out of date. Yeah. So I went to it's a website called National Today, and it basically lists all the fake holidays, and I wasn't expecting there to be like 40 for each day, so I'm just gonna highlight the good ones. Today, the big one is International Cat Day. That is probably the one you would see most people on Facebook posting about. It's every fucking day is some kind of cat day. As a cat owner, I know this. Every day is some weird cat day. National Braiders Day for people who braid hair.
Oh, that's me too. Two for two, man. Yeah. This is my day.
National CBD Day if you are into smoking fake weed. It is a National CBD Day. Digital Nomad Day. That is a day for people who, I guess, work in coffee shops instead of working in an office. National Liam Day. Liam O'Donnell from Cinepunks, it's your day today. You're going to get this belatedly today. I hope you celebrated August 8th, Monday, August 8th, because it was your day.
You get to call Liam Neeson on the phone and say congratulations to him.
Happy birthday, Liam. It's your day. National Pickleball Day, a game I was forced to play in high school because I was a bad kid, and when you're a bad kid you get stuck in all girls gym for some reason. And
I was hoping you were gonna say that your girlfriend made you play it recently.
No,
it's gonna take me some places.
It's Odie Day for the underappreciated Garfield character. Is there any other good ones? I thought there was one. No, I think that's it. I swear there was. No, that's it. National Tarantula Appreciation Day. That's
badass.
Yeah, so there you go. Next week, I'll update you with all the greatest holidays of Monday, August 15th, or whatever it is.
That's funny, because I don't usually do this, but I was doing some cat shopping on Amazon, and I had some of those Matatabi sticks in my cart. You know what those are?
No, I don't.
They're like Jamaican chew sticks for cats.
Oh, they make chew sticks for cats? Oh, man.
Yeah, I don't know what it's made of. It's a vine, and it supposedly cleans their teeth or something like that, and I guess they go crazy for it like catnip, so we're going to find out. I'm going to get some, and I'll let you know if my insane cats are into it.
I might get some for my cats, too. I do have a little Taco Bell news. This week, it was announced that Milk Bar is doing a little collab with Taco Bell. Milk Bar, a.k.a. Momofuku Milk Bar. I know there's one in New York. I assume there's one in L.A., too, but they're kind of a high-end sweet shop. They got very famous with their crack pie, which I think cancel culture has maybe have taken that away, and maybe it has a different name now, but I know they went under fire because you can't even call anything crack anymore. They're doing a collab with Taco Bell, and I think this is the way you go about doing a collab with Taco Bell. This is from Eater magazine, or Eater website. It says, the strawberry bell truffle is supposedly inspired by Taco Bell. And the reason that is because it's a vanilla cake dotted with bits of strawberry and soaked in strawberry milk, filled with sweet corn fudge. And then it outside of that is just covered in bits of the supposed crunchy Taco Bell shell, which is probably the smartest way to do a collab with Taco Bell if you're a high-end place, is use about 3% of a Taco Bell product and then do it. So the reason I try Taco Bell stuff is because it's Taco Bell and it's kind of gross. I wouldn't, like, if I still lived in New York, I would definitely be there day one to get this, but not having FOMO from this. But I just thought it was pretty interesting to see if more high-end places kind of do deals like this, even if it wasn't Taco Bell, just other types of stuff, fuck around and, just use the McGriddle from McDonald's and make the McGriddle bun and make something even better with it. That would be cool. But if anybody out there is from New York or LA and gets a chance to try this this kind of Taco Bell cake truffle thing, let us know.
Yeah, or Toronto or Las Vegas. I just looked it up. Okay. So you got four chances.
Yeah. That's about it. I did go to the fair. I went to the Wisconsin State Fair and ate a bunch of gross food. It's pretty cool. I don't really have anything to report. It's gross. but what I did notice is a lot of people there using those scooters that probably are just lazy, and it's very scary, man. Like I've been getting fat because of the pandemic, and just like I'm not a fucking moron. I know how to lose weight. I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, if I drink fruit punch instead of soda, I'll cut out on the calories. Like, I'm not a fucking moron, but it's just like every day we are faced with some other horrible travesty, and I'm just like, who fucking cares if I'm fat? So I always get discouraged and I just go back to eating like shit. But I do know how to lose weight, so that's in my back pocket if it's ever an emergency and I really need to lose weight. I know how to do it. I'm fucking beaten down by this world, but there's a lot of people at that fair that were beaten down by this world a long time ago that are just like slightly older than us, just no shame at all, just riding around the whole fair and just one of those scooters that that they're free to be given to them. And it was very scary, man. Like, if you're out there and you're on that level of like, I may just give up and start using a scooter everywhere, get some help. Like, I can give you some basic nutritional advice at the least, so can Scott, but I just hope I hope I don't, like, my mom has to use them because she's all fucked up, but she even still walks places, but like if she goes like shopping she has to use it, but like she's old and all fucked up. Like, those are people like in their 40s using them with like no care in the world. Like, this is a normal society to be doing this. So,
well, they should make them fun because they have the ones at the mall that are like an elephant and a unicorn and it has the light. If you're going to ride one voluntarily, your legs work and you're like, you know what? I don't care that my legs work. I want to ride.
Yeah. Yeah. Do something, man. But yeah, I just hope I don't know anybody like that, like personally, because it's just, it's sad to see. And I'm getting to be that age where I might, you know, somebody like, I don't know, maybe Aaron. We haven't seen Aaron in a while. Maybe maybe Aaron comes to Albany or something, or we all meet up somewhere and he's like riding around one of those scooters. Just like,
he's got cool sunglasses on. He's got, sup guys?
Just kidding, Aaron. I know you're not riding in one of those scooters, but you know, who knows? Who knows? If you want to reach out to us, first7inchclub@gmail.com or first7inchclub on Instagram. That's pretty much everywhere. If you want to listen to the records we rip and talk about, you can go to our YouTube, first7inchclub. Follow us there. All over the place, we are at first7inchclub. Tonight, we are doing a record by a band called Beta Minus Mechanic, and the 7-inch is called 69 Camaro. It came out in 1996 on Crisis Records. So this was a record that I've wanted to do for a while, but I have, like, for five times I've talked myself out of doing it. Mostly because it's, partly because it's cheating. It's, they had a full-length CD. Partly because I don't think many people out there will give a shit about this episode. And partly because I know the outcome. Like, I know how this one ends. There's there's no mystery of which way I'm going to go on this one. So it was kind of just like, I would get to like the day before we'd have to do a record, and I'd be like, okay, we're doing it this week, and then I would change my mind last minute because I'd be like, there's no interest in this. But there's certain things I wanted to talk about this record that at least interest me. And hey, why else to do a podcast if it's not to interest yourself? So here we are. If you guys aren't familiar with Beta Minus Mechanic, they were a band. Well, all of them except the vocalist of Beta Minus Mechanic were in a band called Cross Section from Syracuse. Mm-hmm. And they all, I don't know, I think they had one, Cross Section either had one or two singers. I think they definitely had a male vocalist.
They had a
female vocalist too. And I don't know what happened, but at one point they were all like, let's kick out the two vocalists, get a different lady vocalist, and get that money. So that's where Beta Minus Mechanic comes in. I always wondered what their name meant, and I hope I could figure that out. I didn't really figure it out. I did figure out part of their name, which is beta minus is like a physics term. So in my head all these years, I've been saying it beta minus mechanic when it's actually beta minus mechanic. So it's like, it's a beta minus mechanic. And I still think it's probably some Doctor Who shit or something like that. I don't really know, but at least it solved a tiny mystery.
But you'd find it in quotes. If it was used anywhere in the world, you'd find it in quotes, and I don't. I can't find that phrase really used anywhere authoritatively other than for this band.
Yeah. This was pre-Google, but they were like, we need a name that people can Google forever, and they got it.
Yeah.
So here we are. So I kind of want to do this because this came out in 1996, and it was a time when things were turning around. It seemed like there was more bands popping up that played not hardcore. They're somehow involved in hardcore. But they weren't. They were something else. Yeah. And, you know, that's always permeated. This Crisis is a subsidiary of Revelation Records. And Revelation was kind of, you know, they were probably the trailblazers of doing that, of taking all the first wave, like, youth crew type hardcore bands and putting out their second wave stuff, like Quicksand and Shades Apart and what's Super Touch's band? I forget which Super Touch became. Chamberlain? Yeah, Chamberlain.
Yeah.
I don't know if Revelation put that out, but either way.
Split Lip and Chamberlain.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking about. But yeah, you know, they started putting out all those, but Texas is the Reason. They're putting out all those bands, and it was like.
Sensfield.
That's Sensfield. Yes, Sensfield. They're putting all out stuff like that, and it was like, I kind of get it. And then this Beta Minus Mechanic like era kind of, even though it was, you know, months apart, honestly, in real life, but it seemed to be going a little deeper than just we're putting out kind of more mature music because we're 23 now instead of 19. It seemed to be like a little more mature. And I always wanted to, there's not many of these bands that are on like the unknown side, I think. Like, I think they all really went for it. And it's hard to pick one out. So one day when I was record shopping, I was like, oh, here's a perfect one for that could kind of like, I could use as this example for the style of music. So here we are. Another thing is I was like, I'm gonna ace the research for this one, because not only was this band on pretty much Revelation Records, but they're, you know, they're on Spotify. They use their first and last names. This is perfect. And I had an ace in the hole. I was like, I am 1 degree separated from most of these people. Yep. And by somebody who was in a band with most of them. And then I talked to that dude about some mundane band question I had for him like a couple weeks ago, and I didn't want to punish him more, so I left him out. And so that stuck me with not a lot of information. I feel like a big failure. So most of my info is just past stuff. Eric Edwards was the guitarist. He was in Betamine. He was in Cross Section. They were all in Cross Section. Let's get that out of the way. Everybody except the singer was in Cross Section. He was also in Earth Crisis. Unfortunately, he was in the beginning of Bad Earth Crisis. He was he was never there for the glory days. So, and he is still in Earth Crisis. So he's just been writing music for 25 years that no one wants to hear. And everybody's like, no. play Destroy the Machines. And this guy has written 78,000 songs for Earth Crisis. And no one wants to hear any of them. He was also in the new metal version of Earth Crisis, Freya, where they were like, oh, Earth Crisis is getting too new metal. Let's just make a new metal band. He's also in a band called The Farthest Man. And his greatest achievement, he was somewhat in The Path of Resistance, which is probably most people from Syracuse have been.
Yeah, I wish I was.
The guitarist was Jason DeRose, one of the guitarists. He was also in Cross Section. He's also in Another Victim. And at first, when I first started researching that, I was like, oh, that's crazy. A couple of these guys were in Another Victim. It turns out, because that's a connection to a friend of ours or an acquaintance, was Another Victim. And I was just like, huh, there seems to be a lot of people in Another Victim. And I looked at their lineups. I'm like, almost every single record for Another Victim is a different lineup. So I guess it doesn't seem that special to be Another Victim. But that's all I could find on him. Both of these people, I can find nothing. Pete Spielman was in Another Victim. He was in a band called Gatekeeper. He was in Libertine. He was supposedly in Green Rage, according to Stuck in the Past blog. But I have no confirmation of that. He unfortunately passed away in 2016. And then the drummer was Tony Tornabene. He was in all the aforementioned bands, even Freya, The Farthest Man, all those. He's also in a band called Night Owls. He's a drummer. He's in a bunch of bands. Rust, yeah. Empire, Ghost Ship, a bunch of bands. He's the only one I could find an Instagram for, and it was private. And my friend who was in a band with him, but I don't think they were in the band at the same time, doesn't even follow him. So he might have left the core behind. I'm not sure. And last but not least is vocalist Ina Jeffries, and I cannot find anything on her. It's possible she has a different name now. It's not my fault. So hopefully Scott can bail me out and has any cool info about these people who were in a band on a semi-major hardcore label who still do bands who are somehow invisible on the internet to me.
Yeah. This is a rare relaxing week. I didn't have to do any work because Ryan from Hanging Like a Hex and Hex Records posted a comment on a version online.
Okay.
He did all the doxing for us. And he said, it covered most of what you said. Most of Cross Section became Beta Minus Mechanic. The male singer, Rob Van Benskoten, became a raver. Cross Section went through a few female singers before settling on Ina. And at that point, they just kicked the guy out and became Beta Minus.
Okay.
Over the years, Tony would go on and play in every Syracuse band ever, currently drumming in Night Owls. Jason is a manager in Merch Now. That's EVR. Pete joined Libertine for a bit and now just kind of hangs around Syracuse. This is obviously a pretty old comment. Eric did Farthest Man with Tony for a bit, an awesome post-hardcore band fronted by Shane from Framework before he joined Earth Crisis, and Ina became a music teacher.
Okay.
So Eric's the most famous guy, but he doesn't do any press. He doesn't seem to talk to anybody. I even did the forbidden basic bitch move of just Googling Eric Edwards Earth Crisis. I usually don't try and go that like right through Falcon's Maze, right down the middle like that. But this time I had to do it. And he doesn't give any interviews. He doesn't really do any press. There's no reviews about him. There's no one talking about his guitar. he's in Earth Crisis.
He's still waiting to write the perfect song. Once he writes the perfect, the finally something better than Firestorm, then he will do the press.
Yeah, good luck. Freya is funny, though. If people, Freya's a while ago. So if you're you skip them, as I did. I didn't really listen to them back then, but they're a very funny band because they try, later on, they became just kind of Earth Crisis light. But the first album, they're trying to be a regular metal band, almost like a thrashy metal band. And Carl sings melodically.
Yeah.
It's not his forte.
I believe they even have a music video from that era. Yes.
And until this week, I didn't know that there's also a stunt singer to do the high parts that still sound like Carl. It sounds like the same guy. And they're not that much higher, but the guitarist had to chime in for that. And all the vocals are totally unproduced sounding. It's just like a bad demo track. They're on key. Like Carl's on key. I'll give him credit. He is actually singing correctly, but it just sounds like the vocals were done on like your buddy's Tascam 4 track while the rest of the band is all at the gates and shit. They're like well produced. It's a very, very funny video. Track down the first video. So Jason went on to be in Another Victim, and they're on Equal Vision. And I think if you don't make numbers for Equal Vision, Steve puts you to work. So that's why he's bossing around. He probably bosses around people we know because he's at Merch now.
Oh, he still works there?
Apparently, well, that was a while ago. It could have been. He may have moved on. That information is a little old. Tony was in Another Victim, too. He's a drummer. So drummers are beyond the grasp of gods and men. He doesn't get to stop playing forever. Until he gets his first stroke. He's going to be playing drums in someone's band. And Night Owls has the distinction of being on YouTube where a comment burns them to a crisp by referring to them as old man punk. I mean, that you won't come back from that. So the reason you can't find anything about Ina Jeffress is she's now known as Ina Sullies or Solis. Okay. She's a music teacher in San Diego. She does have an internet footprint, but if I told you someone was a music teacher, you know what the footprint is. It's very mild. It's like a Twitter where she just posts about music software and music podcasts and like, you know, stuff like that. And she has a YouTube channel with one recent video of like 30 children in COVID masks playing Let It Be by the Beatles on 30 classical guitars. That's fun to watch. And she's in a surf rock band named the Tourmaliners, or she was. So if you watch the most easily found video of Beta Minus Mechanic Live, the most notable thing you'll see is the bassist, who is this kind of brawny guy with a pompadour dressed like a 90s stand-up comedian.
Yep.
And he's wearing like a blousy, silky teal shirt and dress shoes, and he takes up like a third of the screen because he's like a big hulking guy. And there's not that much out there on him, but he did, like Mike said, he did an interview with Stuck in the Past. And it's a pretty good interview because he's old enough to have been in the Syracuse scene almost since the beginning when there was no hardcore scene. And he gives a pretty good like capsule overview of the Syracuse scene, how it started, how it became kind of a mosh metal straight edge thing, probably because of Steve Reddy from Albany coming with his crew from Albany in their windbreakers and moshing. I guess that's the reason that Syracuse became a mosh place. It's a totally good interview. And then for no reason at all, he ends with an F-bomb. I think he's sort of talking in character. He's saying like, yeah, he was kind of a dummy and a drunk and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't do weed because that was for hippies, he says. And it's real out of the blue and it's weird and it's a weird ending. And this was supposed to be a 4-part interview.
But that was it.
None of the rest of those parts showed up.
Yeah.
And then he goes into the comments and he crashes and burns because a few people are like, dude, what? Why are you saying that word? And he's like, you know, PC is the real fascism. And he like digs in on that instead of just saying, I'm sorry.
I didn't look at the comments. That's fucking crazy. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it was 2010. We weren't aware of how bad the world was going to get. And, you know, Pete never found out how bad the world got because he didn't get it past 2016.
There was one thing I did leave out, and it's not really of importance to anybody but me, but I knew Beta Minus Mechanic came from this band Cross Section, and if you go to the Discogs, it always said emotional hardcore band from Syracuse, and I always wondered what that could have meant in, the prime Earth Crisis time. So I was like, oh, maybe I should finally check out Cross Section since we're doing the band after Cross Section. And I put it on, and there is like a handful of songs that just rattle around my brain, like 90s hardcore songs that I can't place the band because, it's just time and they weren't that important to me. But man, that Cross Section song came on and I know this song. So this kind of like opened a little box for me and I could like place a song with a song that rattles in my head. They were on a comp called Over the Edge Volume 2. If you guys have been a long time listener, you might have heard me talk about Over the Edge Volume 1. It's probably like one of the most influential comps that I listened to back in the day that got me into hardcore. Volume 2, not as good, but Cross Section was one of the highlights. I just didn't remember their name because, like I said, it was unimportant. But it was like the song came on. I was like, I know the words to this. So I was a Cross Section fan, and I was just unknowing of it. So there's that.
Abandon is on YouTube.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It's an album record.
7-inch.
You can find that. Yeah, 7-inch. And it's the girls kind of does melodic backup vocals here and there, and the guy kind of sings like the rapper from Linkin Park.
Yeah,
like
yeah, he does.
talk sings over it. So right. it's kind of emo-y post-hardcore with a guy going,
over it. Yeah, it's good. Check it out. I highly recommend Cross Section. So yeah, the reason I wanted to talk about this is because it's on a record label called Crisis Records. Crisis was a subsidiary record label of Revelation that was co-founded by Jordan Cooper, Walter Schriffels from Quicksand, and his brother Dylan. The label originally existed from 91 to 93, then it was put to rest. Discogs doesn't go into any detail why it existed from 91 to 93. It put out nothing really of note. Put out the Far Side record, put out Onion, which was like... that was like a old school first 7-inch club all over the place record that you would go into every record store and see that fucking Onion record everywhere. But yeah, then it kind of just disappeared for a while. In 1996, Revelation Records employee and former Unbroken bassist Rob Moran relaunched the company to release female-fronted bands, which included Beta Minus, Mechanic, Chinchilla, and Red Five. And that's a weird thing, man. That's a fucking weird thing to be like, I'm going to start a whole label to put out female-fronted bands. I'm sure there was kind of some narrative behind it. Like, this is good. This is, you know, we're doing something. Yeah. But it's kind of odd.
Just put them on Revelation, dude. Just put their albums on Revelation.
So it seems like this was I've always assumed it was a money grab. Like, this is it. This is a piece of Revelation history that might not be as known anymore because it's so long ago. But back in the day... Revelation pressed the vinyl for stuff like Bush and No Doubt. They were like the label for whatever reason that these big labels were going through. So Revelation at the time was flirting with kind of mainstream success as it was in a way. So I always assume that's what this Crisis Records was trying to do at the time. But it only lasted a few releases, and then they took a change again and they started shifting to bands that were quote unquote too heavy, like Will Haven, Spark Marker, later on Shai Hulud. And or to alternative like Overland, and to give you like a little picture of what was going on regular Revelation at the time, they put out 73 Sensefield records in 1996. They literally put out like 73 different Sensefield 7-inches. They put out Civ, like they're putting out all the wimpiest shit in 1996 and 95. And
they were putting out Shades Apart while Crisis was putting out Shades Apart like at the same time.
Yeah, I think even Rev put out a Chinchilla record. So like, I don't really know why they needed a subsidiary. It's always been a mystery to me. It was always weird when that Shai Hulud record came out on Crisis Records instead of Revelation. And it's like, it's been retconned and all those records came out on Revelation. I don't know if they do new presses. And if they do, I don't know if it just says Revelation on it instead of Crisis, but it's always been like this big mystery to me. At the time, Revelation Records was big at the time, but I mean, they're probably not even as big as like a middle of the road record, like hardcore record label now, just because of like how small things were. So the idea of any kind of hardcore record label needing some kind of subsidiary was just insane. So I don't know if it was like a tax reason or what, but it's just always stuck out to me as a weird record label, and I always just wanted to kind of do something from this record label and talk about it.
I didn't really know the whole story about this, and this is a pretty funny little tale of like screwing up a very simple idea. Like, hey, let's just whatever do that. But immediately screwed that up. This finally helped me unravel my lifelong misunderstanding about Onion. I always thought Onion. And back in the day, I kind of figured this out over the time by osmosis, but I'd always thought Onion was one of Mike Judge's weird later projects. And so in my head, when I think of bad, like solo Mike Judge, I think of old Onion. It's been in my brain as old Onion. I know it's old smoke and I know Onion.
Yeah.
Onion had absolutely nothing to do with Mike Judge as far as I know, but it's I can't get that out of my head. Profound Hatred of Man 7-inch is probably the only thing on this label I owned, and it's the only Shai Hulud I like. I still think For the World is a good song. Everything else Shai Hulud did is kind of not my thing. And Chinchilla, pretty solid counterpoint to the upcoming record review. They have an album titled 101 Italian Hits. That's a perfect album title. And they're very weird, like hardcore adjacent dissonant rock. It's free on Bandcamp. I would say check it out. Like it or not, it's an interesting record, and it kind of like hits some notes that I think maybe today's band did not hit.
I was just clicking around on the Onion page, and I did not know until right now that Onion was from my hometown of Bridgeport, Connecticut. So maybe that's why I saw it all over the place.
Yeah,
that could have been the reason why I saw it all over.
It was
over
mandatory.
Yeah, but I fucking saw that record everywhere. So yeah, I guess we can get this record out onto a tray. Nice. Not really much to talk about on this layout. I don't think Crisis was in in the mode to break the bank yet. I think this might have been their first release back. I think they released all this shit at the same time. I don't know. But this is the kind of standard, like, nice cardstock, stock glossy fold-in record sleeve. So, you know, there's no pulling it out of a plastic and unfolding it. It's just, you know, back and front glued together. So, and then you get a little sheet inside. The cover is just, I don't know, you look at it and it looks very 90s, very emotional rock. It's just a lot of white space, kind of like a Mondrian line thing going on, but not really committed. Some kind of vintage photo in the middle, vintage painting. Beta Minus Mechanic in a font I can't place, but it's a very simple kind of curved impact font that you know, I've probably used before. It's a nice clean font. And the back is this kind of the same deal as the song, the track titles. And the cover and there, the insert inside, just one glossy sheet, front and back. Simply has the lyrics, the band lineup, and then the back is another old-timey picture of kids clapping, probably from church or something, and a bunch of thank yous, and that's about it. It's very clean. This looked like something they didn't want to sink a lot of money into, and it just didn't seem like something that was just like... the weird thing about this is that so there's a couple versions of this. There's the version I have, which is black vinyl, and there's a blue vinyl one. Then there's a CD version. The CD version has an extra song on it. And, you know, usually you would get that when the 7-inch couldn't fit another song, but this 7-inch has plenty of room for another song. So I don't really know. I don't know what the deal was with that, like why they left that song off. I don't know if it was like, well, the 7-inch, you know, people relate that with a single, so we have to get them to buy the CD too, so we'll put one extra song. So when this band blows up, everybody will be looking for both versions or something. I don't know, but it's just kind of odd to leave a song off when you have plenty of room to put it on. So, yeah, there is an extra song on, and this is all on Spotify since it's through Revelation. So you can go listen to this pretty easily. But, yeah, it's pretty simple. I would have looked at this. I mean, I did look at this in 1996 and go, nope, not for me. This is some wimpy shit. I can tell just by how, like, the only thing that would have threw me is Beta Minus Mechanic kind of sounds like some kind of metalcore stuff, but it was too early for metalcore, but it definitely sounded like weird hardcore. But the layout gave it away as wimpy shit I would not want to listen to. But, you know, for that, for 1996, it's decent. It's right in the middle. It's not horrible. It's not great. It does its job. It's decent.
So there are some quirks in graphic design that an old head like me can spot. Pretty quickly, and around this time, the de facto piece of print-ready design software was Quark Express. And to be honest, Quark Express fucking sucks, especially for amateurs. And I will teach you now to spot a Quark Express layout. It's always in squares and blocks. Always the text always looks disjointed. People who use Quark always do the letter spacing thing to try and stretch the fonts to fit the, you know, to like justify better. So the kerning gets all weird. So if you see text that looks like it's floating, especially if it's floating over a photo that just stuck in the background, always Quark Express. I could spot it a mile away, and you could spot amateur Quark Express 10 miles away. The painting they use, I think these paintings are cool. Everyone in the world liked the retro marketing propaganda illustration style. That tracks. Everyone in the 90s really loved that stuff. I can't tell what it is. It kind of looks almost like communist propaganda stuff, but not really. Like it could be a gas station attendant in the middle, or it could be a Beta Minus Mechanic in the middle. I don't know what that is. So.
Yeah.
You know, the way everything worked with Quark is that you had to go through this pre-press thing called Flight Check, which was supposed to gather up all the fonts and artwork and stuff and put it in a little capsule so you could send it to a print shop who were going to fuck it all up. They were always going to fuck it up. And that was your whole goal. Once you started designing it for money, your whole goal was to get that file to the pre-press guy, get a proof back that wasn't a bunch of missing characters and RGB artwork with lines through it. And that was the whole game. So you weren't trying to be a good designer. You just wanted no errors. You wanted to see like a press, like a die sub print or something. You wanted to get that back and have like no broken fonts. And if you had no broken fonts, you're like, yes, I'm getting paid this week. It's going to be great. And so when you see thousands of records from the 90s that are all like stripes and rectangles and one piece of art and shitty fonts like this, say a tiny prayer for Quark Express and all the poser amateurs. And, you know, having to figure that shit out on like a pirated software on a 486 PC in 1994 or 1995, that's bad. And this is not the most embarrassing, but it is the most Quark Express piece of design that we've seen on this show so far. And I hate it. I hate seeing it. It feels bad in my body.
Well, there you go. Shitty job. So this record is three tracks. As I said, they left one track off for no real known reason. You know, if you know the answer, let us know. Like I said, 1 degree separated from these people. Maybe we'll reach out. We'll see. So the first track on the first side is called Stay True. So this immediately brings me back to this type of music. This is more like college rock, coffee house rock. Obviously, for the olds, they know that college rock ended up becoming what most people know as alt rock or alternative rock. But there is a clear difference. College rock was not polished enough to become alternative rock. Obviously, alternative rock became its own thing eventually, and it had its own sound, but this sounds like something that would have been in a coffee house in 1994. It doesn't have any kind of mainstream appeal, even though it's trying. You can tell, like, this song is catchy, but it's catchy in a very basic I am not used to having to write catchy songs sort of way, but that's what we're gonna do with this band. We're gonna write catchy songs, so I have to learn, and that's how this is. This is like my first catchy song. Yeah, it was like my first catchy song. So, you know, it might have fooled like younger people like me back then. It didn't, because I wasn't into shit like this, but you know, you might listen to this, be like, oh, this is amazing, but it's very bad. It's very basic. It's, you know, there's nothing right home about. I don't like the bass. I think the bass sounds horrible. I think the lyrics for this type of music, since the music is in this specific splinter genre of hardcore kids trying to do coffee house music, the lyrics always had to be very strong, because there's nothing to the music. It's all, like I said, we are finding out how to write catchy music on the job. So, and we in our brains, all we want to do is mosh, and we want to write shitty music. So it's very hard for them. So you have to have strong lyrics. This song does not have strong lyrics. This song has like kind of basic lyrics about staying true to yourself and some young person teaching the singer how to be true and strong. And it's not so much on this 7-inch. I dipped in their full-length CD, which came after this, came a year after, much more. I wouldn't say much more, but it's a lot of progress on that 7-inch, as far, or on that CD, as far as you know, music, songwriting, and just like tricks and bells and whistles. It's a lot of progress, and that record gets a lot into these kind of vague lyrics about like social topics and stuff like that. You don't want to hear that from this type of music. You're not subscribing to this type of music to hear somebody talking about today's problems and stuff like that. You want to hear like mushy shit. And so the Stay True thing is like, they're dipping their toes. Like, maybe we'll convert some moshers into liking this if it's kind of like Youth Crew lyrics, but not working on me. It's kind of shitty. There's each song features very brief, quick dual vocals. It's always the best part of each song. I don't know if there was a time crunch and they said, well, if you want to overdub the tracks, you got about 15 minutes to do it. So they just picked three
rolling, small, rolling, yeah, tape rolling.
Yeah, so it's like they picked three small parts from all three songs, and that was it. So that's it. Like I said, it's catchy, but it, like I could tell, it's disingenuous. It's bad catchy. So whatever. It's a whatever song.
So yeah, this is a format. This band is a format.
Yeah, yeah.
This song in particular is a format. This is my first post-hardcore song.
Yeah.
Everybody from Mosh wrote a song like this. You know, you find it under your fingers and you go, oh, so this is what it's like to be in Seaweed. I could be in Guilt. I could be doing this. And then you write that song and it's cool. It's kind of catchy or whatever to play that riff. And then you have to fill up the rest of a 7-inch, and that's the hard part. And a lot of bands, you know, fall on their face doing that. Like this song for them, for this band, this is an okay opener. It's a fun riff to play. It's acceptable to hear. In some ways, everybody wins. But these Star Search talent show vocals are killing me. These are not they don't fit. These vocals don't fit. I think the band is doing their part. Like, you know, if you don't like the bass, that's fine. But I think they're talented. They're like playing properly. The mix is very 90s and bad. The guitar is way far away from everybody else. And the bass has no nuts to it. But they're tight. They're talented. And the songwriting is, you know, whatever. But the vocals have no energy. They don't mesh with the music at all. They're just like floated on top. Like, what do you think is the Nevermind of dreary altcore with meandering female vocals? What is the... Or the Rain and Blood. What's the one that made them all do this?
I don't know. I was going to say, like, for me, like, as far as the Nevermind is, like, what I think is the best of this genre, it's always Copper. But I don't think Copper was the... I don't think they were the catalyst to this. I don't really know what it was. Like, I think it just kind of evolved because we were talking about, what, like, Franklin? Is Franklin a female? Or Ashes? It might have been Ashes. I don't know. And back then, when I did not have any kind of access to the internet or anything, I always just assumed all these bands heard the Cranberries and were just like, let's do that, except a little more hardcore. But I don't know if that's true. Probably not, but that's what I always imagined.
It doesn't really sound like anything that was going on, though. Like, because it's a lot... I mean, this Betamize Mechanic is actually a little peppy.
Yeah.
But Ashes, Copper... There was a whole bunch that came out at the same time, like Nine Speed was another one. There's a bunch of them, and a lot of them have that really like mushy, dreary sound that no rock was doing that. No rock was just like like moaning or something like this. So I can't figure out what was the spark that it all happened simultaneously. A lot of bands with very similar formulas. Ashes, they come to mind quickly. Ashes failed the challenge I set forth earlier. They wrote one good hooky song, then they had to fill a 7-inch. They didn't do so good. I don't think anything else they did was that good. So of the ones that I know of, so far, these guys are the most peppy. I'll give them that.
The next track is 69 Camaro. Last song on side A, very weird placement for the titular track. Well, hey, what are you gonna do? This is a little, I think musically this is a little more interesting, greatly more interesting, but a little more. But I had kind of the same gripe Scott had with the first track on this one. The music just sounds so detached from the vocals, and it's like, I mean, I know they're a band, but it really sounds like a band, like the musicians in the band laid down a demo, and then they auditioned singers. And they just had them all sing over a tape. And that's what this sounds like. It just sounds kind of like a singer singing over a tape that they received and not even knowing anybody in the band or anything like that. It's a very weird sound. It's not like, I don't think it's like a recording technique. It's just like, it sounds like very impersonal, I guess you would say. And I think, as Scott said with the first track, and this, it ruins this whole track for me. I think this could have been a good track with a different singing approach, different vocal approach. I don't even think it technically had to be a different singer. I just think... it had to be a different approach, and that's kind of my thesis for this whole record of wanting to do it, is because I think these guys really stepped in shit by somehow befriending the first to second biggest hardcore label at the time and putting out like sub demo worthy songs. Like, this is like very bad. Like, it's not something that should have, like, I don't know how well this was distributed, but it had to be at least 5,000 copies probably, which is, you know, mainstream at that point in hardcore. They probably pressed a shitload of these, it's a 7-inch and CD, and it's undeserving. Like, and you know, I'm like I said, the CD is a lot more progress on that. That I could be tricked into believing the CD deserved to be on like a semi-major hardcore label, but this 7-inch just seems like something that should have been a demo, and they should have cooled it. But I don't know. I guess whoever put this record, this new Crisis directive of having all these all-girl bands, just needed to fill one out and was like, I can't wait, you gotta put something out, you gotta put something on wax, and it was this record. But this song is not good.
Yeah, so you know the bad news. We just talked about the bad news. this still has those problems. Let's work on some good news. They genuinely wrote a second song. Unlike Ashes, they wrote two songs. And I think this one has some hooks. Like Mike said, it kind of rocks. Mm-hmm. It's not just the dull meandering, like slush chord snooze fest. Like a lot of the stuff just does that meandering dull music that it just chords or whatever. And they didn't do that. They wrote it like kind of a hooky little song. And I think this one has a very good vocal part. That little pre-chorus thing. I won't sing it, but there's like a little vocal harmony part. It's pretty catchy and it's well done. She nails it. She nails a little melody. And then the next part is the chorus and it just tumbles into the abyss. It's like, yo, that was the chorus. You're supposed to take me someplace with that. And they don't. And some new and unexpected bad news. Not what I would have thought I would have had to talk about on this record. I think these lyrics are slut shaming, which isn't great. Like this is a song about like how some lady, all anybody wants to do is bang her or something like that. And, maybe I'm misunderstanding. That's fine. No. Track two of their entire career is in murky territory lyrically. But, you know, this is the 90s. They had the right to potentially have whack opinions. We all had whack opinions.
Yep.
Earth Crisis was pro-life in the 90s. Everybody had shitty opinions.
Yeah.
So, you know, go on. Tell a woman she sleeps with too many dudes in your second song ever. Go for it.
So the last track on side B is Missing. This is my shit. This is more like it. This is what I was waiting the whole time for, the whole side A for. You get the moody, introspective guitar dork shit, but it's still rocking. They do the moody, introspective parts, and then they're like, we got to have a rock for the moshers out there. And so they have a rock to it. The lyrics, it has the gushy lyrics that I want from this music. It even starts with "I remember when," and that's how all these horrible mushy emo rock songs start with "I remember when." This one's no different. She even hits like when it starts really building. She hits the somber high note, 10-year-old choir boy territory where she's like really reaching high to emphasize the words, and she's doing that, and it's great. This is as close to Copper as we're getting on this record. It's not Copper. It's not even the same ballpark as Copper, but it's close. We're getting there. They even use their do vocal rations the best on this track. This is as like it should have been the whole thing. That's the one thing where the regular full length improves is like it's 95% dual vocals. They listen back to the 7-inch and they were like, oh, that's all the best parts of all the songs. Let's do that the whole time. And so it's like 95% dual vocals. So it's great. This even has like the big building upbeat ending to give you hope that things will be better and you will get a nice boyfriend or girlfriend someday and everything will work out. So they should have just reversed everything. Missing should have been side A alone and the other two crap tracks should have been side B and no one should have switched to side B. So, I mean, again, it's not, as far as this genre goes, it's not the most amazing song, but for me, this is what I'm looking for this genre. So this is the most passable song on this record for me.
Yeah, there's the most composition in this song, for sure. There's the most like stuff happening. I think Pete is a pretty talented bassist, even whether it sounds good or not, but he makes the devil's bargain where you play chords in the bass. And usually that stinks, but I think that little clean channel intro is the best music on the record. It's the best writing because it's an interesting little kind of indie rock part. I don't think anything else really gets as close to being original. Like that part, it doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard. If you ever formally try to learn an instrument from scratch, like with a teacher, there'll be a time where you're supposed to do improvisation. So you're there with your sousaphone or your like oboe, and you're supposed to improvise over some chords, and you don't know what to do because you're a kid, and you're going to bang on the same note for 20 minutes. You're just going to... You flail on that note for safety because you don't exactly know what else to do. That's what most of the vocals on this track sound like to me. It sounds like she's making most of the... I mean, there's good parts, but a lot of it sounds like she's making it up on the spot, and like she's just trying to stay alive over the chords. Mm-hmm. So she's just howling whatever note fits. And even when it gets to the punky fast part, she just keeps going... That's like a battering ram in my skull hearing that note over and over. And the punky part should have been the end because that was a good punky part. And then it keeps going part after part keeps happening. And I'm like, this song was done a minute ago. You got to punch the fucking clock, man. You got to bail out of this song. There's too much of this song going on.
So there you have it. There's on Kissing Contest, my old podcast where we talked about movies and television. There was in the later episodes, the later seasons of Kissing Contest, we did a thing where we watched a full entire season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And luckily, I don't remember much about it because I did not like that show. It's critically acclaimed. Who knows why? But it was. Yeah. And there was like a coffee shop or something, or I don't know, a restaurant or something in that show. And it was still during that time where it had music that was like this. It was like not quite ready for primetime music. And it was probably because it was, you know, it was cheap to get bands on like unsigned shitty bands to be in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, probably paid them like a couple hundred bucks. And that's exactly what this reminds me of. So my rating system is usually throw it in the trash, stream it. I should say that slower, throw it in the trash or stream it or buy it in the bargain bin or buy it for full price or buy it for collector's prices. I think this is streaming. I don't think there is I don't think there's a nostalgia or a market for that Buffy the Vampire Slayer unsigned hype type of music, but there may be someday. So maybe I don't think so. I think everybody from every angle possible has perfected or improved upon this thing that Beta Minus Mechanic is doing, including them on their own CD. But
yeah,
maybe, who knows? Who the fuck knows? No one could predict what is going to be popular to some weird kids. So stream it if you are into Buffy the Vampire Slayer. If you want to know what unpolished indie rock sounded like, anything like that. Like I said, it's definitely not for me. It never was for me. I liked Copper. This was pales in comparison to Copper and many other bands of that ilk. It's a cool time capsule. I'm glad we finally got to do it. And I guess open somebody's eyes to a part of Syracuse they probably did not know existed. And I don't. Did you never saw this band? Did you, Scott?
I think I did. I knew about them for sure, and I knew that they were a going concern. And I think I saw them at a show, but I can't really remember.
Yeah. Because I could be just misremembering this, but in my mind it was one of those bands that just like were kind of headlining shows as soon as you heard about them. They weren't showing up to the shitty local show and playing in front of like 12 people. Like I'm not saying their shows were packed or anything, but it seemed like they were as soon as I heard of this band, they were automatically high on the bill. And that happens a lot now. I think, for the past 20 years, I think that's happened where a band will just appear and they will be second billing for some reason because somebody's marketing them or hyping them. But that was a new phenomenon in 1996. If you were not like, no one cared about Cross Section, maybe in Syracuse they did, but no one around the rest of the country or the Northeast cared about Cross Section. So it was very weird to be a band that got stuck on a big label that was already playing like second to last at shows. So it's a weird time in history. So at least stream it if you're into weird historic hardcore stuff, weird Syracuse history or stuff like that. I don't think it's a thing that needs to be in anybody's collection, but I don't think it's complete trash just for the historical, I guess, I don't know, you know, the little nuggets you can get out of it. But yeah, stream it.
Well, if you're 39 with a Hot Water Music tattoo on your leg, you're going to tell me you like it. So you might as well get it. You should probably pay for it. there's almost no sound within the range of human understanding that zaps me back in time as thoroughly as this kind of music, this genre of music. This is like Quantum Leap for me. I'm back. Like it's 4K. I'm there in 4K. I'm in my straight edge Snapple parody shirt and I'm trying hard to have a good time at this show and it's not working out for me. And that's, I don't even know if there's as many bands that sound like this that I actually think of, or if it's just confirmation bias. Like, it's probably four. But to me, there was like 30 bands that did the you know, the mushy, squishy indie rock female singer thing that got on hardcore gigs. And it felt like my lane at the time. So I tried, because, you know, I was into like weird bands with female singers. I like Stereolab and Bjork and all that kind of weird shit. So I was like, I should probably like it in hardcore. But I remember being disappointed by Betamize Mechanic in real time, because they had this sci-fi name. They had Syracuse cred, all this stuff, and then they showed up and they were this band. I was like, ooh. I think everyone involved in this deserved better. Everyone in the band and the listener. Everybody deserved better than this. Because the musicians have skill. They're playing very well. There's like no flies in this band. When you listen to this, you could be like, wow, they're really tight. Like, they're actually good at their, you know, the mix aside, they're good at their instruments. And I think they should have pushed, and maybe they did for the CD, they should have pushed Ina to put some more guts into it, or at least edit her lyrics a little bit. And maybe she should have just been like, hey guys, my sub karaoke night voice isn't blending with this mid tier plinky plink core. I'm going to go get my chops up in some kind of like Edie Brickell situation somewhere else instead. And that probably would have been good for her. Like, to be in another band where you get your chops up not singing over hardcore dudes.
Yeah.
Which isn't traditionally the best music to like learn how to sing over. Within the constraints of this dull micro blip subgenre, I think Betamize Mechanic wrote some songs. They had some musical hunger. I think they wanted to be a musical. But I enjoy almost everything that came after this era a lot better than this era. Like, you know, not very long after this, a lot of ladies were all of a sudden like, fuck this, I just want to scream. You guys are all screaming. I'm going to scream. This is stupid, you assholes. I'm going to like yell too. And then the other ones were like, you know, fuck this. If I'm gonna be poppy, I'm going to be in the Anniversary and like have some fun playing pop music, or Mates of State or something like that. And they gave this up. So I give this 2.4 unused beer tickets out of 5.
Well, there you go. Not a hit. I knew this ahead of time. That's why I didn't want to do this episode. But it's done. It's in the books. I can scrape more of the bottom of the barrel, because I still haven't bought new records. But I don't think any of these people really have the internet, so I don't think they have to worry about them reaching out to us. But yeah, if they do, hey, we're sorry. You're old now. You probably understand, so it's okay. next week we'll do something. I don't know yet. I have to go dig through the piles and see what'll pop up. But until then, Scott, do you have anything to say?
Just fuck Charlie Daniels.
Yes, just fuck him. Fuck Charlie Daniels.
Just fuck Charlie Daniels.